Well, I bet you didn't expect to hear that sound in your podcast player anytime soon, but I am here. It is me, Christian Cawley. I'm not with James McLean this time. He did the last one. I'm doing this one. He had a guest. I've got a guest. It is Philip Bates. Hello, Philip. How are you?
Hello. Very good. Thank you. And yourself?
Yeah, can't complain. Well, I can, but that would be a different podcast altogether. So, yes, we haven't spoken in a while properly, and I thought I'd I'm quite interested to find out what you've been getting up to, because I know you've been doing your own thing for a bit recently.
Yeah, I think the last time we spoke was just after the Starbeast. So, yeah, quite a lot's happened since then.
Loads has happened since then, yeah.
Yeah. So, personally, I've been doing a lot of work for Candy Jar Books. So I've got some cool things coming up to do with that. And obviously, yeah.
Yeah, we spoke to Candy Bar some years ago, talked to Sean and Hannah as well regarding the Brigadier stuff.
Mm.
So that's interesting. How long have you been working with them now with Candy Jar?
That is a very good question. I think I started out with, it was just a short essay for a Brigadier book, marking his 50th anniversary.
Right.
So, yeah, that was a few years
2017?
It was the Brigadier Declassified, so whenever that was. I think it might have been 2017, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe 2019 it actually came out,
or okay.
18, something like that. And then that gave, I did a piece about Nicholas Courtney's life as told in 13 objects, and that span off into a 100 objects of Doctor Who book.
Right.
Which, you know, it was a very enjoyable thing to do, and fortunately it seemed to go down pretty well, so Sean's brought me back in to do some more stuff.
Excellent. I'm very interested to see, we'll expand on these a little bit later on. In the meantime, regular listeners will note that I didn't review the last episode of Doctor Who when we've been reviewing all the other ones. And with myself and James, then with you and other guests. And I think I would like to know what you thought of the Christmas Doctor Who.
I thought it was a step up from the 60th anniversary specials, to be honest. The only one I enjoyed mostly of those is The Giggle. Because of the Toymaker, the first half was I thought, excellent. Actual Doctor Who again, which I've been sort of sadly lacking for a few years now. And then the bi-generation thing I thought was codswallop. But, but I sort of accepted it because the new Doctor's very good. Shuti is very good, I think. And I liked most of the Christmas special. It was uneven. It didn't always work. I don't think the Doctor's alien enough yet. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't as good as say 11th Hour or Christmas Invasion. Those sort of actual Doctor debuts, but it was fine. It was sort of average. Okay, Doctor Who.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure that you loved it, didn't you, Christian?
I hated it. I was on board until the singing bog monsters. Trogs? What were they? The trolls? Whatever they were, those things.
Goblins.
Goblins, yeah. Thank you, yeah. Then, I mean, I was kind of on board up to that point, and then I was completely lost. And I also found, I thought Shuti was good in the sort of post by generation scenes in the last episode, the previous episode. I didn't like him in the Christmas special at all. I thought Millie Gibson was absolutely superb. It was she just like did that thing that Russell T. Davies has done with companions in the past, of like focused the show around them. She carried it perfectly well. She was brilliant. And so, I mean, I'm a little bit disappointed to see she's not going to be there sort of a longer term as a regular. But no, I just, the whole thing just fell apart for me around the singing goblins.
Yes. I have a friend who particularly likes musicals, and even she thought it was a bit much.
Well, my wife loves musicals. She just picked up a tablet at that point and didn't watch the rest of it.
Do you mean medication, because it was that bad?
I'll do the jokes. No, she meant...
Well, feel free.
Yeah. I'll do some at some point, yeah. Actually, my wife's got some very, very, very particular views on mushrooms. She believes... She honestly believes Japanese mushrooms are superior to British mushrooms. I think that's a shit take.
Wow.
You asked for it. So anyway.
I'm regretting it.
So yeah, so I mean that's my thoughts on the Christmas special. And then, I mean, I was very, 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 very grumpy about it. Hence me not joining James in the last podcast, because he really wanted to talk about it. He enjoyed various elements of it. I just didn't get. I want to forget about it, really. So
I think Millie's quite an interesting one, actually, because I think the media has given her absolute hell. For really terrible reasons, actually. If she's in, I think it was expected that she's going to be in 3 episodes next series as well, something like that, then she'll have been in like 13 episodes of Doctor Who, which is, you know, in 9th, 10th, 11th Doctor sort of era-ish, that's fine for a companion.
Yeah.
And I also think that maybe she's not actually done yet. I think potentially there could be more with her in a sort of Martha role.
Right, yeah.
You know, if she gets taken in by UNIT, I suppose it depends on who her mum is, doesn't it? But, you know, if her mum turns out to be Kate, for instance... Well, then it's only natural if Ruby turns up in a UNIT spin-off.
Right.
I mean, okay. I don't know if there's going to be a UNIT spin-off, but, you know.
That's a bit soap opera.
Well, Russell does like his soap operas, to be fair.
Well, yeah, okay. That's a fair enough point. Yeah, I suppose so.
I think in the latest Doctor Who magazine, Russell says they're filming more with Millie anyway.
She's just simply not going to be primary companion in the second series.
Possibly. Because I think it was weird that Russell didn't actually jump up and defend her after all the rumours abounded. There was something very curious about that, because even when, say, Christopher Eccleston left and everything was leaked, they put out a press release, you know, it was horribly wrong, but they acknowledged it, and this time they haven't, and that's strange, I think.
So we mentioned earlier some books that you're working on. You sent me a list of them. We've got to get this one out of the way, otherwise it's going to be bugging me for the rest of the show. The Raccoons, Philip. What's going on?
The Raccoons. Yes. Back when I was a kid, I used to love the Canadian animation, The Raccoons. I thought it was fun, had great messages, lovely animation. They've relaunched. I believe there's a whole new series. It's probably on one of the streaming services. And Candy Jar has got the license to do 3 new books.
Right.
So I was very, very lucky in that I got to proofread them and write all the blurbs, which as a fan, as a kid, it was I don't want to say a dream come true because that's a bit cliche, but you know, it's something that I'm still very excited about.
Sure. Okay. I'm looking at this. I mean, I remember the Raccoons. My it wasn't quite aimed at me. I think it was aimed at my sister, who's 5 years younger than me. So right. It wasn't really something that particularly interested me, but I'm aware of it, and I remember the characters. I'm just looking at the new artwork. They've got slightly bigger eyes. They look like they're all on meth or something. Their eyes are big and round, whereas before they had seemed to have a bit more character to them, more oval, angular, but now they're big and round, like they've just done a line. Yeah.
Oh, no. well, that's updated.
Well, indeed.
2024.
Yeah.
No, they do live in a forest, so.
Oh, well.
No, the illustrations are.
Chewing on cocoa root.
The illustrations are done by a great chap called Terry, and it's very reminiscent of the classic 80s, 90s style. Each book has added elements in, which are quite fun, that stuff you won't see in other kids' books, actually, which I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about yet, but
okay.
You'll see whenever if you ever pick one up. But Terry's illustrations are throughout as well. And yeah, they're very evocative, very warm, friendly. And yeah, they're just really fun books, really.
Was there a Cyril Sneer in your life?
Yes.
Oh.
No, there wasn't.
All right, okay.
I was going to highlight you, Christian, but...
oh, how mean.
I'm glad you remember Cyril, though.
He's the only one I do remember, I'll be honest with you.
No, that's fair. He was the standout. He was the kingpin sort of character. The Green Goblin of the Raccoons.
So that's one of the things that you're doing. Have we got a release date for that project?
Yeah, so they're... Well, I've got... they're coming out on the 28th of March, I believe, in the UK, but they're going across the world, as far as I'm aware. So
wow.
I'm not sure when they're out in sort of Canada, America, wherever.
But well, that's this year.
Be around the same. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So just less than a month.
That isn't the only thing that you're working on. Before we do that, you sent me an image of the. I thought it was some sort of artificial intelligence nightmare creation. You sent me the cover of the new Celestial Toymaker Blu-ray disc.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it would give you nice little nightmares for the next week.
Well, do you know, I mean, I saw it last night. I didn't actually have a nightmare about that, although I did have a nightmare about an ex-girlfriend. So maybe it inspired it.
There you go.
So thanks for that.
That's my pleasure.
What is going on with that illustration, though? I mean, I don't want to call out any illustrator. I don't want to say, you know, art is art and interpretation is interpretation. I don't feel that accurately represents anything other than some sort of combined archetype of the Celestial Toymaker. It certainly doesn't resemble Michael Goff.
No. I think... charitably, I can say that it represents the animation style, and that's charitable. So it's a departure from the previous animation styles, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. It feels, I mean, clearly there's a 3D world being created for the animation, and there's all the various camera work that goes around in a 3D world, as there would be in like a 3D video game or anything like that. Some of the character designs are interesting. I noticed from the trailer, I don't know if this will be throughout, but some of the lip syncing is out, and that seemed to be where it was noticeable. It wasn't perfect, and then a lot of the trailer was long shots and zooms, so you wouldn't notice. True. So that's interesting. I wonder if that's a thing that they do throughout the action, because that could be quite distracting if there's lots of long shots odd over the shoulder shots or whatever. It's 2024. There shouldn't be a problem with lip syncing a digital creation to audio. It's just what I feel.
I think the closest to it that we've had already is episode 3 of Web of Fear. And yeah, the lip sync of that seemed a bit odd, but I didn't watch the whole thing because I just couldn't bear it.
Okay.
I had the sort of the privilege of editing Colin Howard's book, his art book on all his VHS stuff and everything. And he worked on animations like Evil of the Daleks and things like that. And so I've seen the behind the scenes of how much work goes into these things.
Sure.
So on one hand, I feel that, you know, you don't want to devalue or degrade this animation, but equally, the older animations clearly had a lot more effort and love and work actually put into it, into them, which I think is a worrying development.
Do you feel the factory sort of processing them, production line sort of?
Yeah. I think if you compare, say, the animation for the moon base, now that, you know, lots of people don't like that as a story, but the animation is superb.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they've got limited budgets, but they did it back then. So I think, you know, more than 10 years on, we should be a step forward from that. But we're not.
It's interesting that you mention time, because the first thing that struck me when I saw the lips move was the David Tennant, the second David Tennant animation.
Oh, Dreamland.
Dreamland, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. And that was 2009, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that. So, yeah, we're talking 15 years ago. There should have been some form of evolution on, you know, matching the lip movement on a 3D model with the audio, one would feel, in that time frame.
Yeah. And, you know, they've been able to match animation with audio since like the 30s. So.
Oh, you stick that knife in there, Philip.
Just saying.
Okay, let's move on from that, because you've been busier than I have anyway. In this regard, companions, 60 years of Doctor Who assistants.
Yeah, so this actually hasn't been announced yet. So this is
announced it.
You have.
Wow.
Yeah, there we go. So thanks for that. Thanks for this plug. So essentially, Andy Frankham-Allen did Companions 10 years ago. For the 50th.
Yeah.
Well, just over 10 years. And so that book was, you know, it's a massive thing of beauty. 340-ish pages. Going into each companion, and not just what you see of their story on TV, but also all the expanded media.
Right.
So it's a huge undertaking. And I believe that it was one of Candy Jar's most popular books, understandably. It got good reviews, and it was reprinted a couple of times, but it ended with the name of the Doctor.
Right.
So since then, there's been a lot of stuff added.
Yeah.
So essentially, it's been my job working with Andy and Sean to bring it bang up to date. So that's numerous new doctors, numerous new companions, many new companions, and lots of expanded universe things.
So do you need to listen to all of those and read all of those for that, or does someone else do that, or what?
It's a bit of a mix, really. Some stuff I've read or listened to, some stuff is just compiling the most important story beats. You know, we don't list every little thing that happens, but if we learn something important about a specific companion in a Big Finish story, for instance, then that's got to be noted down. It's similarly the companion's relationship with the Doctor, with each other, if there are numerous companions. We've obviously had numerous companions come back as well, and either on TV or, for instance, Mel and Ace travelled together for Big Finish. So how do they get on beyond Dragonfire, for
right.
instance?
Yeah.
Which has been a very interesting thing to look at. But obviously very extensive. And really, if even without updating the 50th anniversary book, all the new material that we're adding to it would basically be a new book anyway, you know?
Sure.
So we're sort of hoping that, well, we think there's enough in there to justify such a massive page count.
So how long is it now?
The process started with trimming back what we've got, adding in a new essay at the start. We've got a new cover, we've got a new introduction and foreword. So it's coming up at about 400 pages at the moment, and that's without, I haven't added in stuff for the 13th Doctor, 14th or 15th yet.
Whoa.
Yeah, I've got, and actually the 12th, I've written it, but in a separate document that I've not actually added into the main document yet.
Right, right.
Because I'm worried about the page count.
Sure.
You know.
as you would be, yeah.
Yeah. But nonetheless, it's been a very fun, extensive process, and I've been working on it for maybe 6 months to a year now.
Wow, okay.
So in that time, obviously we wanted it to come out earlier. But because I think we all underestimated how much has been added in 10 years, the project has been more focused on being thorough than being quick, you know? So it should be out in a few months' time, I would think. But I'm not sure exactly when.
Fingers crossed on that one, then.
Yeah.
We're all behind you, Philip.
Thank you very much.
And are we also able to talk about Unit, A Legacy of Doctor Who?
Yeah, so that one I've proofed, essentially. It's written by Baz Greenland. And it's essentially celebrating 50 years of Unit. It's sort of a good primer for people who don't know loads about Unit, because it goes over every story. But it's also good for people who know Doctor Who inside out, because you get there's nice new interviews with say John Levine, Sophie Aldred, so there's a lot of stuff added,
right,
beyond the standard. So it starts off with the origins of Unit, behind the scenes and in narrative.
Okay.
Going to, you know, Derek Sherwin and that whole period of the second Doctor, going into the third, and obviously the edging into the fourth. There's quite a bit on the Brigadier, as you can guess. And then there's a really nice chat with John Levine, actually. It's very warm and enthusiastic. He's never really hidden how much he loved his time on Doctor Who.
No, no.
What I did learn about it, actually, was that Richard Franklin wrote a theatre show.
Recall, oh, yes.
Unit, The Great Teabag Mystery. I knew nothing about that until
reading this. That rings a bell. That rings a bell.
It was something to do with Maggie Thatcher being kidnapped,
yeah.
I believe, by the
master. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. I knew nothing about that. But
Was it produced for theatre or was it produced for conventions?
I think it was produced for the Fringe initially.
Right, okay.
I think it was possibly acted at a convention, but I think it's one of those sort of lost chapters of Doctor Who.
Yes. I imagine a lot of people are quite happy about that. I was wondering about unit dating, and when I say unit dating, I don't mean Captain Yates and Joe Grant. I mean, obviously it didn't happen. No, but more along the lines of, you know, the whole the timeline and how it's, you know, bounced between the 70s and the 80s, or maybe even beyond at times. Is that addressed in the book or discussed in the book?
There is a whole chapter.
Just the one?
So, well, several footnotes as
okay,
well.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, there's a chapter about that. And I knew the basics about the unit dating, but I didn't realise how messy it had become, how convoluted and why as well. I think the nice thing about this book is, obviously, I've been a Doctor Who fan since 2005, and I've done a lot of research into it, but there's still a lot that I learnt from this, has been great.
My main theory about the unit dating is no one would care if William Russell had been in Mordrin Undead.
Yeah.
The fact that they cast Nick Courtney to reprise the Brigadier, that just throws the whole thing up in the air. I think everyone would just generally overlook it as just being quirks of, you know, the 1970s sci-fi TV show. But the fact that they do that with the Brigadier is, I think, what breaks it.
I think you're right. Yeah, wasn't it William Russell was just too busy or something?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. Which is hardly a surprise because, he's been, I mean, obviously he's very, very old now, but, you know, throughout his career he's been gainfully employed as an actor from, you know, the 50s through to the late 1990s. So it's hardly a surprise that he would have been too busy to do a bit of Doctor Who when he could have been in the theatre or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is Mordrin that basically upsets the whole apple cart, because I don't think there's too much in Battlefield that questions the unit dating particularly.
No. Possibly a bit about what we know about the Brigadier, but that's about it, really.
Yeah. I can't really remember what year Battlefield was definitively set, apart from somewhere in the late 80s.
I think it was set in the 90s.
Was it?
I think okay. So. Early 90s, I think. I think it was one of those sort of near future sort of things, or like early mid 90s.
Which sort of fits in with the Third Doctor era as well, because obviously that was set in the near future, and they just never really gave it a specific date. I'm not sure if Terror of the Zygons might have tampered with the unit dating a little bit. So all the specific details aren't quite there at the moment. There's a lot of interesting stuff in there. There's new interviews with Sophie Aldred and Joseph Lidster as well, talking about UNIT in relation to Torchwood, which is quite interesting.
Yeah.
All the stuff on New Big Finish. So I think there's a lot of good stuff in there. But if you're just quite unfamiliar with UNIT, maybe you just know Kate and Osgood, well, this is a perfect book to pick up, really.
This is the book for you?
Yeah, yeah.
So when's this one out?
Imminently.
Oh, right. Exciting. Check the Candy Jar website for details, I imagine, is the instruction there.
Yeah, I've no idea about pricing.
I'll stick a link. I'll stick a link to the Candy Jar website in the show notes. While we were talking about Dot 2 books and Dot 2 related books, I recalled that beside me I have one of the various tomes that I requested for Christmas, waiting for me to read it. It is 42, Douglas Adams, which has been edited by Kevin John Davies, who many of us will know. And there is a section, a chapter about Doctor Who in there, which is worth reading because there's some very interesting materials in there.
Yeah, I saw that book in Waterstones. I saw it on Amazon and just thought, oh, it's just another book about Douglas, you know, because he's perpetually popular, so it's just going to be rushed out. And then I saw it in Waterstones and was amazed by it.
Yeah,
it looks incredible. It's massive.
It reminds me of a Monty Python book that came out about 20 years ago. It was full of similar sort of information in terms of, you know, scans and materials and scripts, segments and notes and things like that.
Right. Nice. Yeah, it should have been on my Christmas list, actually, but it slipped through the net.
Yes, get yourself a copy. I don't know when I'm going to get to it. It's on the to read list, as it were. And now I've just a little bit of a tech talk. Now I got a new phone, which is one of those ones that opens out into a tablet, which means that anything that I've got in digital format, I can just read anywhere. Because I used to hate reading on a phone, but now this fold this is one of those Samsung Galaxy Z Folds. It folds out into a small tablet, so you've got better reading space. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's very cool. They're ridiculously expensive as well, naturally. It's just a nice thing to have for reading.
Oh, very nice.
Well, nothing beats a book in the bath, obviously.
No, quite. I can't read books on tablets and things.
I don't read that many books on it. I read magazines because I have a Readly subscription, so I use it for reading mags like the Blocks magazine,
right?
Which is the Lego magazine. It's about Lego. It's Lego. Have you not come across that? It's in W.H. Smith usually. It's good.
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's a good magazine. That, yeah, I enjoy reading that. So there's that and Computer Active, and I check out my articles in Linux format and whatever else I've been working on. And it's not all about me, obviously. There's other things that I read. magazines I'm pitching to, for example. It's good. It's a good app, is Readly, and plenty in there. And there's tell you what's in there as well. Vortex is in there. The Big Finish magazine.
Right, okay.
That's in Readly, so you can get that in there. And like Readly, God, this sounds like one of those ads that you get on podcasts. This isn't a sponsored thing. I'm just recommending it because I'm impressed with it. Readly costs like £7 or £8 a month. And you can read as many magazines as you like, and you keep them after that as well. That's the other great thing about it.
Wow.
So,
Yeah, that's quite something.
Yeah.
I was quite impressed with Spotify Premium. They added lots of audiobooks recently. And I think you only get like 30 hours as part of your subscription each month.
Yeah.
But that's a lot. A lot of audiobook, you know?
That is a lot of audiobook, yeah. And again, this isn't a sponsored section. We're just recommending. It's like an ad hoc recommendation.
Yeah.
Oh, you're getting paid for it. Sorry, my mistake.
Yeah. No, that's fine.
Philip is pulling in the Spotify dollars there.
So have you got a favourite Doctor Who book that you've read?
Are we talking non-fiction or fiction?
Yes. Apart from mine, obviously.
That was a good one. Do you know, Doctor Who books are very strange because you can like them one week and hate them the next. That's in particular the fiction books. Because of my, I don't want to say age, but age, there are many Doctor Who books over the years that have appealed to me. I mean, the books by Jean-Marc Lefissier are very well-thumbed reference books.
Oh, yeah.
are from the late 80s, 1990s, Universal Data Banks, etc. So they were certainly favourites for a long time. Gary Russell's Regeneration book was my go-to .2 reference book in the late 90s because it was about the TV movie. The VFX book by Matt Irvin and Mike Tucker isn't just about .2, it's about general BBC stuff, but that's another one that I spent a lot of time reading over the years. And Adrian Wigglesford and Andrew Scullett's Compendium of Monsters is another one that I've also pored over the years. And, of course, Peter Haining's classic A Celebration.
Ah, yes. Okay.
More recent books I've enjoyed a lot. The Legend was a good one, but that's, you know, that's 10 years old now. So
The Legend?
Yeah, that was like a 50th anniversary coffee table volume.
Yes, that was very good.
Yeah.
I got The Legend Continues shortly after that.
Ah, right, okay.
And that was, I think that might have been my first non-fiction Doctor Who.
Oh.
It was either that or The Shooting Scripts for Series 1.
Okay.
That was an excellent book.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, yeah. So, which one's your favourite?
For fiction, I think it might be Dead of Winter. That was a 11th Doctor one. By James Goss.
Okay.
And it was so surprising. There's I can't say too much without spoiling it, but something happens about a third of the way in that completely changes your view of everything you've read beforehand, which was very interesting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's worth picking up, I think. I liked that whole range, actually, the new series adventures. I picked up a few of the past Doctor adventures, like The Time Travellers by Simon Gurrier. That was excellent, Byzantium. But I've never delved into the Virgin New Adventures or anything like that. I'm not sure if they're for me. I'm guessing you've read a few of those, have you?
Yeah, I read quite a lot of those back in the day. I actually started with a book by Paul Cornell called No Future, which was a really bad place to start because that was kind of fifth in a series of five interlinked novels, which I didn't realise at the time when I bought it. I just fancied reading a Doctor Who book, and that was the one that they had in my local W.H. Smith's. There's a couple of others and a couple of the reference books, but that's one I started with. And then when I could, I got hold of the previous four editions and fit it all together in the wrong order. But no, you can, I mean, it's they all stand alone anyway. So it's good. It was not the best place to get started, but it was good nevertheless. I have a lot of Doctor Who Virgin in BBC books. I didn't get all of them, but quite a lot of them. But I tell you what, there is one that I really, really like, and that it probably stands out. There's a couple of Eighth Doctors when he was stuck on Earth books that I really like. But the one that probably stands out the most of all the Doctor Who novels, by past and present, by famous authors and non-famous authors, is Harvest of Time by Alistair Reynolds. I think that's probably, it's a big shout to make, but I think that's the best Doctor Who novel, certainly, of the 21st century.
Wow. Oh, wow. Okay. That's quite a recommendation.
Yeah, that's a third Doctor novel with, it's also got the Master in it, at least one Master. And there's an audiobook version read by Jeffrey Beavers, appropriately enough. So, that's a good one. That's the one I would recommend people start with, basically. Because, you know, you've got a strong Doctor Who era. You've got, it came out in 2013, so, you know, they obviously wanted a lot from it. It's got a good audiobook version, and it's written by Alistair Reynolds, who is one of the premier science fiction writers. So,
yeah, is it hard sci-fi?
It has hard sci-fi elements to it, but not in the same way as the Stephen Baxter book, which I struggled with. Stephen Baxter is very much a very hard sci-fi writer. He is known to be an admirer of Doctor Who, but he didn't quite get it right, in my opinion, whereas Alistair Reynolds absolutely did.
Right, Yeah. There's Michael Moorcock. He did a Doctor Who book.
Exactly the same as Stephen Baxter.
Yeah.
It had some really, really good ideas in it, but it just didn't quite feel like Doctor Who.
Yeah. That was coming of the Terror Files, wasn't it?
That was it, yeah.
Yeah. As you say, the ideas in it and some of the imagery and some of the prose were lovely, but I don't think I ever heard the Doctor in it or Amy. Yeah, it's weird, I think, when authors can't nail a voice, particularly when it's somebody on TV.
Yeah.
I think, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think with Stephen Baxter's book, it felt maybe like one of the more outre Virgin New Adventures, whereas the Michael Moorcock, the Stephen Baxter ones, I think it's a Wheel of Ice, but Coming of the Terror Files, yeah, I don't think I got to the end of it. It just find Doctor Who in it, basically. I found the characters, but they weren't really the characters, and it wasn't really Doctor Who. So
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Alistair Reynolds Harvest of Time is my recommendation.
Very nice. Mine would be Dead of Winter, then,
okay.
I think.
Yeah.
Actually, you saying about... Right, so earlier on, we talked about the raccoons, and that might have been, you know, completely divergent, but there
this
is...
This means I can't cut that bit out, but no, carry on.
No, you can't. this is important, Christian. So... There's a couple of Doctor Who links, because the first one is written by John Peel.
Right, okay.
So there we go.
Yeah.
Virgin Adventures.
And the other link?
And the other link is that the second one is, it's written by Ian McLaughlin. So he was former editor of the Beano, but he's written, obviously, lots of Doctor Who books and Tomorrow People and...
I honestly thought you were going to say something like Toby Haydock or even Stephen Moffat then. I thought you were going to like pull out a massive name out after John Peel. I thought John Peel was leading to like a bigger name. Or that Terry Nation had originated the raccoons or, you know, anything like that.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint. The TARDIS is in the third book, if that helps.
Okay. Right, well, that brings us to the end of this month's Doctor Who podcast. I have promised the listener, Philip, that I am working on a podcast that has been sort of like lost to time that I found the data for. And I did find the data for it, and I have polished it up with some AI techniques to bring the interview subject to the foreground. However, I have to say, it does require a lot of editing because of other conditions and other scenarios, and it's going to require some framing. Now, it was James who conducted the interview with the person concerned, and I really want it to be good before I share it, basically. So I don't know if James is going to be available to do the linking narration, which makes it sound like makes it sound like Sharda, doesn't it? I don't know what the timeline of that is at the moment, but it is something that I am dipping in and out of and trying to work out exactly how we're going to present this, because it was an interesting topic. Now I've found the data, and I've used some artificial intelligence linked sound processing to rescue the audio. To make it listen to me, because you can't just share. You could a few years ago, you could get away with sharing really bad audio on a podcast, but it's 2024 now and you really can't do that now. So I've improved the audio.
This is your now and then.
I don't get the reference.
Oh, the Beatles.
Oh, right. if you like. Yeah. If you just said free as a bird, I'd have been with you. I've cast Now and Then from my mind because it was appalling.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. I really didn't like it at all. Especially as it came out more or less the same week as a brand new Rolling Stones record, which was absolutely storming. Now and Then just failed. And, you know, I don't think Ringo and Paul liked it particularly because they couldn't even be bothered to get together for the video, you know, so.
Oh, the video is awful.
Yeah.
But I loved the song, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It was just the artificial intelligence link.
Yeah, no, no, yeah, yeah. See, my mind, when you refer to the Beatles and artificial intelligence, I'm thinking of the whole 9 hours.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Which I sat through and enjoyed immensely. I never thought I'd ever sit through anything that long, the Get Back sessions, that long, and be that interested in what was going on, you know? Because you're basically just watching some guys talking for a bit and hitting instruments 90% of the time, very randomly and quite poorly. And yet, it is fantastic.
You're
selling it. I know, yeah. But and yet, you see everything behind the scenes, there's a whole... you see how well they get on, even when apparently, allegedly, you know, but according to historical record, they're not getting on. What were they like when they did get on?
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
I've not watched it yet.
Oh, right. Oh, no, you should. It's really,
as you say,
really
good. 9 hours.
Well, yeah. Well, you don't have to watch it all in one go. You can pause it or, you know.
Oh, okay.
Episodic.
That's,
yeah.
That's a new feature, is it?
It's yeah.
I'll look into it.
You certainly should. You certainly should. So as I say, we are at the end of this month's Cast Arbus. So it's a bit later than expected. You know, things happen. Thank you, Philip, for joining me this time around.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm glad you've enjoyed it. It's been good talking to you again. I will be back, I think, myself or James or both of us at some point soon. We will be back. Until then, it's goodbye from us.